clear information about how to complain, whom to complain to, the timelines for resolution, what they can deal with, what they can't deal with, and if they're unable to resolve it, how to get in touch with the Rail Ombudsman.
And just briefly, because there was great fanfare about announcing rail fares in England being frozen in 2026 for the first time in 30 years, is it going to be at the expense of services?
Let's hope not. I mean, that's we certainly don't want to be want to see a decline in services. Clearly, the government is taking the view that by bringing more of the rail companies under one roof, that that will lead to some efficiency savings. And, you know, there's clearly a logic there. I can't say whether that's going to succeed or not, but there's clearly an underlying logic there. So we would hope not to see a decline in services. And we know services are incredibly important to people. There's no point paying for something really cheap if it doesn't function.
Absolutely. Alex Campbell, thank you very much for joining us. That's it from me for this afternoon on The Times at One. My producer today was Lizzie Highfield. Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. I'll be back tomorrow at the same time, but next up it's Fee Glover and Roy Anika here on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio.
Coming up on our programme today, calls for an apology over the British spy in the IRA and his role in murders and kidnapping. We're going to talk to the journalist John Ware about Steak Knife. What is it like to be handed a box of disorganised files and realise that the person handing them over to you knows more about your childhood than you do? We're going to talk more about the campaign to get care leavers better access to their records. Our big guest after 3:30 is the author Sebastian Faulks. And there's trouble in Cambridge. Did a tech company steal Christmas? Oh, boo, hiss, boo.
First, the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The security services tried to conceal the truth over the army spy codenamed Steak Knife operating inside the IRA, according to an independent report. Freddie Scapatici, who's never officially been named, was linked to 14 murders and 15 abductions as he worked in a ruthless IRA unit known as the Nutting Squad. Operation Kenever has concluded that more lives were probably lost than saved through his actions. The Times chief reporter, Sean O'Neill, explains more about the man.
Freddie Scapatici was the most prolific agent British intelligence had within the IRA during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. He produced more than 3,500 intelligence reports, and his handlers basically turned a blind eye to his involvement in serious terrorist activity, including the murder of other agents, because they were obsessed with protecting him, because they were in awe of him, because they owed what this report calls a perverse sense of loyalty to them.
A former Children's Commissioner for England will lead the grooming gangs inquiry. Baroness Anne Longfield says her review will not shy away from difficult or uncomfortable truths. Her appointment is likely to be welcomed by many families, but some had wanted the inquiry to be led by a judge. Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood made reference to the Casey report in the Commons, saying it's not just the crimes that are shameful.
There was also an abject failure by the state in its many forms to fulfil its most basic duty: protecting the young and vulnerable. Worse still, some in positions of power turned a blind eye to the horror, even covered it up. Despite a shameful lack of national data, Baroness Casey was clear that in some local areas where data was available, and I quote, disproportionate numbers of men from Asian ethnic backgrounds were amongst the suspects.
Fraud and error from COVID-19 schemes cost taxpayers £10.9 billion, most of which will never be seen again. That's according to a report which found rush schemes like bounce back loans and eat out to help out left major weaknesses. The head of NHS providers, which represents hospitals in England, has told Times Radio people with colds or coughs should wear a mask to stop the spread of flu. Daniel Elkalis says everyone should try to get a vaccine.
If you haven't already had your flu vaccine and you're eligible, please go and take it. And if you're not eligible and you haven't had the flu already, then it's probably the best £15 to £20 investment you could make by going to your local pharmacy and saying, please, can I have the flu jab?
Health bosses say up to 8,000 beds could be taken up with flu every day next week. And Australia has become the first country to introduce a minimum age for social media users online. Platforms like Instagram, TikTok and YouTube must now block the accounts of children under 16 in the country or face a fine worth up to £24.7 million. And for News Bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB. Online and on your smart speaker. Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
That takes us to 4 minutes past two. Welcome to Tuesday afternoon. Christmas has come early. Roy Anika is with me today on the afternoon shift. Stay with us for all of your news and Christmas trimmings thrown in for good measure. It is free Christmas lunch day in the Works canteen here at Times Towers. How can it be that even with all the gorgeousness of a Christmas lunch, the overwhelming vapour is cabbage? And it's all over the building, but it did look like a very, very fine spread. We're going to start the afternoon by talking to the journalist Jonathan Ware about the truth about Steak Knife, who knew what and when. It really is quite the tale of power and covert strength. But who was ultimately better protected, the spy or the victims of the group he was spying on? The Cambridge tech company who took over the Christmas market in the city cannot possibly have foreseen the backlash they've got, and we're going to add to their woes by talking to a victim of Christmas present. It's a man from Kent who couldn't get his Christmas presents. In health news, we're going to consider today's maternity service report. So, so distressing and depressing. After three, we're going to hear from Jackie McCartney. Now, Jackie was brought up in care in the 1970s and 80s, and she waited to access her records until she had brought up her own family, not wanting anything she found in those records to get too much in the way of her own experience of motherhood. But when she did access those records in her 50s, they were few and far between. They were heavily redacted. Even the name of her sister was under black pen, and she tells us why today's recommendations from the Information Commissioner's Office about children in care and their records are so very important. After 3:30, it's a little stocking filler, isn't it, Roya?
Yes, it is. It is. It is our big interview with the author Sebastian Foakes. He has written a memoir, a reluctant memoir, he says, which is a wonderful book, Fires Which Burn Brightly, A Life in Progress. So I've talked to him all about why he decided to write a memoir, his issue with what he sees as the overdiagnoses of things like ADHD, mental illness. And we dip into a little bit about his greatest novel, I think, Birdsong, and whether or not it's a help or hindrance to have that in your back pocket, in your archive. And also a little bit about James Bond, because he wrote a fantastic James Bond book a few years ago. So I asked him about that too.
Are any of his thoughts about overdiagnosis? Because actually he spent so much time himself as a novelist writing about the distress caused by war in particular to a generation of particularly young men. Do you think that that informs some of what he's talking about? Because people often want to make a comparison to a different time when perhaps the bar around what you were expected to do and therefore have going on in your head, it was different. It wasn't better, but it was different.
I think there's a bit of that. And he does talk about that, you know, what the wartime generations endured versus now. But I think from our interview, you know, he is someone who has had mental illness. You know, he doesn't like the phrase mental health. You know, he says, why are we suddenly calling it mental health? We have mental illness. He had an episode at Cambridge University when he was a young graduate there. And I think that and his experience there and beyond have sort of shaped his thinking of it. His take on it is we need less medication and more young people need an arm around their shoulders.
Well, we will be delighted to hear more in that interview after 3:30 this afternoon. It's Roya and Fee with you until 4 o'clock. Our modes of communication remain exactly the same. We're Jane and Fee, confusingly, at times.radio, and our WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353. Anything that we're talking about, we love your thoughts about it. And if you too tried to go to the Cambridge Christmas market and were turned away, I'm sounding a little bit like Bethlehem now, then we would love to hear your experiences. And even better, if you were in the Christmas market having a great time, we'd love to hear that too. What are the most read stories on the website so far today, please, Roya?
The most read stories on the Times website this afternoon are, at number three, Storm Bram to batter Britain with a month's rain and 90-mile-per-hour winds. The Met Office has issued yellow weather warnings with a threat of flooding, power cuts and serious travel disruption across the country. The second most read story is the top six retirement regrets and how to avoid them. Times' Money's retirement columnist, Beck Wilson, has that rundown with some helpful advice. And the most read piece on the Times website is Hugh Edwards condemned as shameless for social media portrait. A professionally shot photo posted on the disgraced newsreader's Facebook page has prompted speculation he's planning a return to public life. And you can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. And if you don't have one, you should get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
British intelligence protected, paid and pampered Britain's top spy inside the IRA for half a century, ignoring his role in kidnaps and murders. As you will already have heard if you've been listening to Times Radio today, it's the conclusion of a 9-year official investigation into the crimes of the man codenamed Steak Knife, known now to be Freddie Scappaticci. It was led by former Police Scotland head Sir Ian Livingstone, who was asked today if the British state should apologise for its role.
Yes. And that was one of the recommendations in the interim report. I update on that, in that it hasn't progressed. There's been various reasons for that and levels of delay or some might say procrastination. But absolutely. We haven't specifically mentioned that in our opening remarks this morning, but we absolutely feel there should be an apology, just exactly as outlined.
But while the final report criticises MI5 and Army Intelligence, it was blocked from formally identifying Scappaticci. And we can talk about all of this now with the Times' chief reporter, Sean O'Neill. For people who might just be joining us this afternoon, Sean, can you just explain what Freddie Scappaticci actually did, what we now know he did?
Yeah, Jane, Freddie Scappaticci was a very senior member of the IRA and specifically part of the IRA's internal security unit, which was a particularly brutal group of killers whose job was to find, abduct, interrogate, and by interrogate I mean torture, suspected informants within the IRA's ranks, and then almost inevitably execute those people. And those people were executed with a couple of bullets to the head. The bodies would be left on waste ground or on border roads as a warning to other people. And Scappaticci's unit was known as the Nutting Squad because of that method of execution. But all the time he was hunting IRA informants, he was Britain's biggest intelligence asset within the IRA himself. He was spying on IRA operations. His unit had the job of vetting new recruits to the organisation, and he was very close to some of the Republican movement's leadership, so he was able to pass on information on political and paramilitary strategies.
How extraordinary, Sean, was it that this spy got into that position? And does that in any way justify the world that then began to exist around him, where, as the report reveals, he was given a level of protection that many people who were victims of the ring that he was in would find difficult to understand? They didn't have that protection themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's an almost unbelievable story when you the more you dig down into the weeds of it, as this report has done. You know, he had there was a dedicated army intelligence unit set up to look after him. MI5 agents were embedded in that unit. They had their own premises within army headquarters in Northern Ireland, buildings called the Rat Hole. He had access to a 24-hour dedicated phone line he could call at any time. And he was lavished with tens, hundreds of thousands of pounds in the end. I mean, he really did benefit personally, financially from this involvement. And it was felt by those handling him that he was invaluable. He was described as the golden egg of British intelligence. He you know, some of the handlers who were questioned by Operation Canova, this investigation, asked the investigators, why are you investigating a man who should be given a medal? He should be having a special medal struck for him. You know, there were people who felt that he was absolutely invaluable in bringing the conflict to an end and pushing, by undermining the IRA, by pushing it towards the peace process and away from violence. But there are others, if I would say, who were not involved directly with him. So I know people who were working in RUC Special Branch at the time who absolutely knew about Scapatiti and hated him because one of the things he was doing was arranging the murder of their informants and thereby cutting off vital sources of information.
Yep. I mean, given that and the serious nature of the things that the man was involved in, how much difference, and I don't want to be cynical about this question actually, Sean, but how much difference would a government-backed proper apology make?
It would make a difference to the families of the victims. If you look at, there are people who were ostracised within the nationalist Catholic communities in Northern Ireland because the IRA branded them the families of informants. In many cases, they were not informants. The people were killed out of power struggles or personal rivalries and then branded as informants. But these were people who couldn't go to the police because to go to the police during the troubles within those communities would have led you into further trouble. They couldn't get anything from the IRA, any explanation of what went on. And now those people, I think they deserve an explanation. You know, it is more than 30 years since Scapatiti was a valuable agent to the state. It would be a good, accountable thing to do for a government that says it's committed to investigating and explaining the legacy of the troubles in Northern Ireland to say to those families, we're sorry, we employed a man who was a killer and a torturer, and we got it wrong at times. It just would be a progressive move and a real comfort to those families.
How difficult would it be for the current government to make that apology?
Well, it's not hard to say sorry, is it?
Yeah. Well, we'll wait and see whether or not that comes good. I was quite interested to read about the bits that we still don't know, though, Sean. So we don't really know how much Scapatici was paid, do we? His will is sealed and presumably stays sealed for another couple of decades at least.
His will has been sealed by the High Court until 2095. And there's been the explanation given by the High Court was that is to protect the beneficiaries of his will from possible reprisals. Now, most of Scapatiti's family live openly in Belfast and have not been subject to any reprisals or any threats. So I don't really believe that. I think that what's happening here is that we have, you know, MI5 has pushed to cover up his will because they don't want to disclose how much money he was paid. That's one of the great secrets of espionage is how much money we pay agents. And what we can glean from this report is that Scapatiti received hundreds of thousands of pounds, if not more than that. He had a house bought for him in Guildford when he was living in hiding in the south of England. He never needed to do another day's work after into hiding in 2003. He was paid up to £80,000 a year at times when he was working in Belfast. You know, he benefited from this hugely in a financial sense.
Mm.
And Roya might be interested in this. Yeah. The only other people whose wills are protected
Here
and
we
sealed
go.
In this
it's
way
the royal family.
Are members of the royal family. The monarch's will is protected by law, but by legal convention since 2010 or something, about 30 members of the royal family have had their wills protected. And there were challenges recently to the wills, to make public the wills of Prince Philip and Princess Margaret and the Queen Mother. All those challenges failed. And to that select band of royals, we've now added the name Freddie Scapatiti, serial murderer.
I mean, it is just quite an extraordinary thing.
It's unbelievable,
that, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Sean, thank you very much indeed. We really appreciate your time this afternoon. The Times' chief reporter, Sean O'Neill. I mean, it is quite the story of Freddie Scapatiti and those little details that are really worth thinking about too. His family that still lives out in the open, they've had no need to conceal their identity all of the money that might have been held by him and therefore his family over the years, and the difficulty, obviously, on both sides of weighing up the balance of good intelligence versus people who are being essentially taken out under state orders. All of your thoughts are very gratefully received by us this afternoon. We're 0333 003 2353. Just on that point about royal wills, do you think that in the next couple of years that's going to be one of the things that has to change as we ask for more accountability from the royal family?
It's a really tricky one, isn't it? The royal family being the public family that they are. Are they entitled to privacy when it comes to their own private arrangements? They could make the argument that they are. Will we start seeing the monarch's will unsealed? I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. I think there'll continue to be a lot of demands for it, though.
Yes. And do you think it might be one of the things that will start to be asked for more after the Public Accounts Committee sets to on the Crown Estate, which I can't help but thinking is just, and that's going to happen later on in the summer, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's due for publication in next June.
Yeah. It just starts a conversation that I think an awful lot of people have felt that they're not allowed to have, and it will be displayed on, it'll be a streamed select committee session. We'll be able to see on our televisions members of the royal household, perhaps even a member of an ex-member of the royal family themselves, be asked all of the questions that you must want to ask them all the time.
I agree. I think on wills, it's one of those things that the royal family might say, we feel entitled to medical privacy. We also feel entitled to some form of family business privacy, by which I mean, you know, the firm, the family. But people will keep asking the questions for sure. Mm.
That takes us to nearly 19 minutes past two. Coming up, we're going to talk about the company that stole Christmas. This is Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
This Christmas, the Times and the Sunday Times are raising vital funds for three deserving charities, Switchback, Kissing It Better and World Bicycle Relief. And this Thursday from 10 a.m, the Times Radio presenters and contributors are answering the phones. So if you call to donate, you could be speaking direct to Danny Finkelstein or shooting the breeze with Stig Abel. The Times and the Sunday Times Christmas Charity Appeal 2025. To find out more about our nominated charities, search Times Charity Appeal now. Thank you. Calls charged at standard rate.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage, and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Bathrooms. The free bathroom design service includes a home visit. So when you're ready to plan your new bathroom, let the Wix experts measure up for you. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, if you have presents still left to buy, of course you do, we've got the perfect gift for you. The Times Bookshop has got some fantastic titles, whether you're a literary enthusiast, a culinary connoisseur, or somebody who simply enjoys a good page turner. The Times Bookshop has got something special for everybody on your list this Christmas. Times Plus members can get an exclusive 1/5 off 100 thingy discount. Just visit timesbookshop.co.uk or you can call 020 3176 2935 for the perfect gift this festive season. If anybody managed to write that number down or can remember it, then I'll give you a book myself. Go to the timesbookshop.co.uk. I think that's the easiest thing to do.
Now, children were left in tears when thousands were turned away from a Christmas market in Cambridge after a tech company booked the venue for 8 hours on Saturday. Arm Holdings,
a semiconductor company worth more than £100 billion, spent hundreds of thousands to take over the market for staff and their families. Craig Duncan, a solicitor from Kent, was among those who was turned away, and he joins me now. Craig, thanks for joining us. Can you just talk me through your weekend and what actually happened when you tried to get into the market on Saturday?
Yeah, of course. So we had planned a day out in Cambridge. My daughter's at university up there. We hadn't seen her for a while, so we went up to see her, had lunch. It was my wife's birthday, so her and her brother took my wife and us out for lunch. In the afternoon, we planned to spend at the Christmas market. And then in the evening, Alex was singing, my daughter was singing in a carol concert at one of the colleges. So we were going to go there. So we kind of had the whole day planned out. And we have a lovely lunch. We get to see her, which is nice. Go walk over to Parker's Peace, start walking over to the market. And we see lots of people outside. So our original thought was, oh, it's full up. They're stopping people going in. They're holding people, fine, we'll wait. And then when we get there, there's kind of some raised voices, some quite distressed people. And then the two security guards looking a little bit amused and frazzled a bit by what people were saying to them. And I just said to them, what's going on? And they said, oh, I'm sorry, it's booked for a private event. And I said, well, all of it? And they said, yeah, the whole thing's booked out until 6:30. And I kind of looked a bit bewildered. And I went, this Saturday afternoon, somebody's booked it until 6:30 today. And he said, yeah. And then some other woman over my shoulder said, I've got three trains to get here today. Like, my kids are crying. She was upset. Her kids were upset. Like, this is ridiculous. Why is it closed on a Saturday? I mean, there's other things to do in Cambridge, right? So it's not completely wasted. So we went down to Mill Road and there was a kind of street market down there, but it wasn't the big event that's been on social media that everybody's been going to. So, yeah, very disappointing. And then we found out that it was, you know, a Christmas party for staff.
Mm.
Just raised loads of other questions, like, you know, why are you sending staff to go to a Christmas party at a weekend? Like, they should be doing it during work time. So just lots of things just didn't really add up today. And it was a bit of a spoiled afternoon, really.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, Craig. Can I ask, is that Christmas market, is it a particularly extremely special Christmas market? I mean, does Cambridge have something that, you know, makes it really, really special, something that you're really looking forward to?
I mean, it's been all over quite a few of the social media. It's been on Instagram quite a lot. It has Ferris wheel. It's in a nice location. Obviously, you know, Cambridge is a beautiful city anyway, so... And, you know, we had ties to go up there. You know, we do like Christmas markets. We've been to them overseas as well, which are nice. But I think it is one of the prettier ones around kind of the south of England, to be honest with you. The ones in London are just in streets. So, you know, you've got Winter Wonderland in Hyde Park, which is great. But
yes,
this was a free one to go around and have a look. And also, you know, it didn't look that busy inside. And I kind of somewhat felt sorry for the stall owners. You know, the point of going to these markets is you're able to go and buy trinkets or handmade goods. And I mean, who's going to buy those if it's a corporate event? They're not going to be doing that, probably. So I kind of felt a bit sorry for them. I wondered how much the money they would get.
Can I ask, Craig, in terms of presumably you saw lots of other people being turned away, is the feeling that this just wasn't advertised enough? Like, was not enough notice given that it was actually fully booked? Because obviously a lot of people turned up expecting to be able to walk in, and were told when they arrived, literally at the gates, no, it's privately booked. Should there have been more notification given? Was that the issue?
I mean, hindsight's a great thing, right? And there's people saying, oh, you should have checked. If you're driving 2 hours to go to market, you should check it's open. Like, we checked when the market was on from, so we knew the dates. I wasn't particularly expecting it to be closed for a private event on a Saturday afternoon. I mean, to me, that's prime time for the market to be open. There were posters outside when you got up to the front of it saying it was closed for a private event, but I hadn't seen anything, like, I heard anything on the radio. Again, they're quite prominent on social media, and there was nothing I saw about it being closed on Saturday. But I mean, it probably was on their website. I didn't look afterwards, but I'm sure it was.
And can I ask, it's a big tech company that took over this Christmas market, so it's a very different thing, I suppose, to a charity taking over it for its staff. How did you feel sort of particularly annoyed that it was a big tech company that had paid all this money to deprive other people of going into the Christmas market on a Saturday?
Well, I didn't know who it was until later on in the week. And it kind of, it did irritate me a little bit. I mean, it's one of those things. If you can afford to do something that you want to do, then I've got no problem with you wanting to do that. I think my point is that they could have afforded to have done it at any time, right? So why did they pick a very popular time for local families and people going to see it? It just seemed slightly elitist in my mind. It's kind of like, you know, taking the spoils out of what Christmas spirit should be just for your own benefit. I mean, great for their staff. I'm sure they had a great day, but, you know, why they've had to give up their Saturday to do that. They could have done that on a Wednesday, Tuesday afternoon. You know, it just didn't seem to be a Saturday afternoon. So, I mean, as to who did it, I just think it was wrong to have done it anyway. And, you know, part of it is the organisers' fault as well as the company. The company got offers to buy it, and the organisers shouldn't have sold it, in my view.
It would be intriguing, wouldn't it, to know whether or not the stall holders did actually make a decent amount of money. Because I take your point, at a corporate do, I wouldn't then expect to go and do all my normal Christmas shopping if I was also, you know, if I had my, as Roy knows, my happy smiley work face on, greeting all of my colleagues.
I know it well.
So I think those are two separate things. Sorry, that was a rather dastardly laugh there as well. It is a story that Roya and I disagree on as well, isn't it?
I suppose for me, you know, one of the things that we read about so much and politicians talk about a lot and people who live in communities talk about is that local authorities and councils are cash strapped and don't have enough money to provide the services very often that people living in those communities want. This is a council, presumably, that has been paid quite a lot of money by a big tech company. Surely some of that is, one would hope, is going to go back into the community for services. How else are councils supposed to make their money?
Mm. Well, I like your train of thought. It went much further than mine, which was just bah humbug. What a nasty tech company.
I should also say that the closure was advertised on its website, and they have said sorry to anyone who arrived during a sold-out session. I should flag that, Fee.
Okay. Well, Craig, very Merry Christmas to you and your family. Hugh said, is this the dullest story of the year? No, we're still looking, Hugh. And Beryl, the yellow Beryl, says, ladies, I'm going to sound very smug. All gifts bought, wrapped, posted, and have even started buying a few bits for next year. Oh, my Lord. And this one in from Neil, who says, I lived in California in the late 90s and early 2000s, and the tech companies would hire out whole theme parks for their staff parties. But I never heard anybody grumble once, and maybe this highlights the cultural differences between the US and the UK, where the former were genuinely pleased that successful people had the great opportunity of a day out, whereas in the UK, it's all grumble mumble about stealing Christmas. I've got my hand up in the studio for that one, Neil. Why would anyone travel many hours to go to a Christmas market? I hope they took the opportunity to see many of Cambridge's other less commercial attractions. Maybe Santa was sending them a message. Well, Craig said that they did. They found lots of other things to do. But yeah, I wouldn't travel that far for a Christmas market.
And not unless it was exceptional.
I just wouldn't travel that far for a Christmas market.
No fair.
Coming up, almost £11 billion in taxpayers' cash, that's our cash, was lost to fraud during the pandemic. We're going to ask how, and that'll be after the very latest news headlines with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A report has found a British agent who infiltrated the IRA carried out some of the worst crimes imaginable. Investigators say there were serious failings by MI5 as Steak Knife carried out murders and torture. Lawyer for the victims' families, Kevin Winters, says it's wrong that his identity hasn't been made public.
It's a slap in the face by the state at a time when there ought to be the most fulsome of apologies over what was a state-sponsored murder operation lasting 15 years from 1979 to 1994.
The agent has widely been identified as Freddie Scapatici, although he denied that until his death 2 years ago. The Grooming Gangs inquiry will be chaired by a former children's commissioner. Baroness Anne Longfield will take on the role, which will go on for 3 years with a budget of £65 million. Taxpayers lost £10.9 billion because of fraud and error from COVID-19 schemes. A new report says major weaknesses were left by rush schemes like Eat Out to Help Out and furlough. Pope Leo has reiterated the need for continued work in achieving a just and lasting peace in Ukraine. He's met Volodymyr Zelensky following the president's talks with European leaders in Downing Street yesterday. And Australia has become the first country to introduce a minimum age for social media users online. Platforms like Instagram, TikTok and YouTube must now block the accounts of children under 16 in the country or face a fine worth up to £24.7 million. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
This is Times Radio.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silver Sea brings you closer to the rare, the remote, and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate. To finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Christmas was a tough time in my family. I became homeless as an adult. I had to turn to a food bank.
This Christmas, your gift to Trussell could help provide emergency food and expert advice. For people like Aaron, it'll be a lifeline.
This Christmas, my dream is that people leave the food bank with hope.
If you can, please give to Trussell today. You can help food banks provide an emergency food parcel and support someone facing hunger this winter. Search Trussell today.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wix for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Coming up at 4 o'clock, it's John Pienaar on Drive. John, what have you got coming up? What are you talking about today?
Well, I mean, the story, the report, that teenagers, 1 in 4 teenagers, are using chat GPT, other chatbots, to share their mental issues with, their strains and their worries and their anxieties. Hit me really, really hard. I mean, depending, I guess, on how you define seeking mental health support, it can mean, there's a huge spectrum, I guess, that phrase could cover, from anxiety to someone wanting someone privately to talk to, that they trust and feel they can speak freely to, in this case, a phone, chat box, or someone with real issues of strain and needing professional guidance and help and human contact. Whatever it is, that number really hits you. And I'm going to be talking about what it really means and represents, talking to the founder of a company called Limbic, which is the only clinically verified therapy chatbot. The others are not. And so he can give us some insight into what these chatbots can do if they're used properly, and what they can do if they're not, and why we should be concerned about this, because it does sort of feel as if we perhaps ought to be. I'm going to be talking about Ukraine, as we do most days. I don't know if you saw yet the interview that President Trump gave to Politico, where he's tearing to European leaders for being weak. It doesn't, apart from anything else, it doesn't really promise a lot when it comes to, will President Trump be there to support a new set of peace proposals for Ukraine to be presented to Putin and pushed on Putin? It sounds as if he may be leaning just the other way. So I'm talking a bit about that and about the 100 billion euros, which is game-changing money that looks to be on its way to Ukraine. How is that going to be spent on the front? Maxim Tucker has been on the front line. You will get some of his observations there. And in daily life in Kyiv, what does it mean for just keeping the place going? Schools, hospitals, what's the state of life? And Kira Rudik is a Ukrainian MP, can talk about that. And there's some good news, the leukemia cure, which is being reported today, and other things too. It's going to be a busy programme.
Busy programme coming up from 4 o'clock. Look forward to it, John.
Now, fraud during coronavirus cost British taxpayers £10.9 billion. It's the judgment of the independent COVID counter-fraud commissioner who's investigated the money lost during the pandemic. Tom Hayhoe's report found that schemes like the Bounce Back Loans and Eat Out to Help Out had huge fraud risks and no safeguards. Well, Daniel Bruce is the chief executive of the anti-corruption group Transparency International. Daniel, do you think the report has lifted up the right stones and found the right things underneath them?
Hello, good afternoon to you. Yes, there's £10.9 billion of loss to fraud, I think, does appear to be pretty definitive when it comes to essentially, you know, money which was taken through fraudulent means from those accessing things like bounce back loans, furlough, the Eat Out to Help Out scheme, and so on. It's a very depressing picture, and that's a very significant amount of public money. However, It isn't still, I'm afraid, the whole picture when it comes to the runaway train of public spending that we saw on PPE and testing, the very significant corruption risks that we've identified through two forensic studies that we conducted in recent years into government spending. We already know, prior to today's number, that the Department of Health had previously written off around £15 billion of PPE and testing kits, and Mr. Hayhoe's report looked at PPE a bit. It didn't look at the sort of corruption and cronyism side of it. And also, he didn't look at testing. £23 billion was spent on testing contracts. Again, they had a very controversial VIP lane for contracts to be signed with government for that. And if there wasn't necessarily fraud or corruption, there was considerable price inflation, which all added to the tab that the public purse is now picking up.
OK, well, let's just talk about the testing. And I'm only going to leave PPE because we talk about that in a different context quite a lot. But can you just explain to us how money could have been siphoned off or prices overinflated? And the counter argument to that, Daniel, is always going to be this was a time of national crisis. How could anybody have accurately tested the system in order to make sure that money wasn't being wasted? Don't we have to view some of these things with a little bit of different understanding to normal times?
I think that would be a fair assessment if we were talking about the way that government spent money, say, in the first month or two in the peak of the crisis, and when, you know, we know that there were significant concerns that we were going to run out of PPE in the spring of 2020. Last year, we looked at all 5,000 contracts that government had signed for PPE and testing, and found that the high-risk measures that it was using in terms of protecting the public purse and not exposing it to risk of corruption or price gouging went on not just for months, but they went on for years, right out to 2023. And I think that's also reflected in the COVID Counter-Fraud Commissioner's report today. Many of the economic stimulus programmes that he's looked at that were intended to get the country bouncing back were well after the heat of the first wave of the pandemic. And it was when the government was trying to get the country to reopen again. And what he finds again is systemic weaknesses, poor data, weak accountability, poor contracting mechanisms. And yes, part of that was because we went into the pandemic very ill prepared. But across the piece, I think we now have mountains of evidence that there was very poor quality decision making, both by officials and senior members of the government over a sustained period of time.
Yeah. The VIP lane, Daniel, was just bizarre, wasn't it? Did another country have a similar thing where it was just so openly identified and so openly used?
In a word, no. And, you know, we looked at this again very extensively across our network of, you know, hundreds of national chapters, other experts in the field, such as Open Contracting Partnership. And we could not find anything that looked like a VIP lane. Remember, there were two VIP lanes. There was one for PPE that was set up in the spring of 2020. And then another one came along later for testing contracts. And what made them unique was that the qualifying criteria to get into the VIP lane was whether or not you knew a high-profile or influential politician connected to the party of government at the time, or a very senior civil servant, for example. The PPE VIP lane did not even ask the most basic of questions as to whether or not these suppliers had any past experience of producing PPE. And therefore, it's no wonder that we ended up with dog food manufacturers and lingerie companies producing our PPE, which was later found to be unusable, instead of credible suppliers who knew what they were doing. So, you know, you get a little bit of that in today's report, but that is all part of that wider picture of this cavalier attitude to spending of public money over such a long period of time.
So we're going to estimate at least £10.9 billion was lost to fraud, Daniel. I mean, this is money that nobody's ever going to get back. We're not going to ever see that again, are we?
So the slight silver lining in today's report is that around £1.8 billion of that 10.9 has actually been recovered already, so that the total fraud price tag is just shy of 11 billion. 1.8 billion has been recovered. And I know that the Counter-Fraud Commissioner's view was often that, you know, these fraud cases were always going to be those where there was the most potential using the legal instruments available to get money returned to the public purse rather than, say, you know, concerns about price inflation or corrupt practices leading to the award of contracts where that's more difficult. But that's still many billions of pounds that he now takes a view are probably beyond reach. 1.8 billion is about as good as it's going to get. On the PPE contracts, which again ran into billions and billions written off as unusable, we have a figure in the low hundreds of millions that's been recovered so far. And that, again, is probably as good as that's going to get now.
And how much did this report cost? And do we know how much the cost of prosecuting fraudsters will eventually be?
That's probably a question for the Treasury rather than me, I'm afraid, but it's a very valid question. I mean, you know, we know from data that came out earlier this month that government has already spent more than £100 million more than it expected to responding to the COVID-19 inquiry, which in itself is costing north of £200 million. So, you know, there are other examples like this where the costs of the accountability and the lessons learning are running to very high price tags as well.
Daniel, I think we rather pride ourselves on not being a corrupt country and sometimes find it quite easy to point at other countries and say one of your problems is corruption. But does this prove that I'm wrong, that we've changed?
Well, that's a very timely question because just yesterday afternoon, the UK government launched its first anti-corruption strategy since 2017. So that was a very welcome development. And that actually does provide a very candid and frank assessment of corruption risks that the UK faces, not just internationally and from malign actors, but also domestic corruption risks, you know, insider threats in police and border force, for example, and also a candid appraisal of some of the lessons from the pandemic period and the sort of crisis of trust that this has created. I think for us to be able to tackle corruption risk in our society, we first have to be willing to talk about it. And certainly in our annual index on corruption perceptions around the world, we've seen the UK standing steadily falling to its lowest ranking, scoring 70 out of 100 in that impartial index over the last few years. And we know that a lot of that was driven by what happened during the pandemic.
Yeah. And do you think because the pandemic was so tough for so many people, and I'm not excusing fraud at all, Daniel, but, you know, there were definitely cases of people who they knew what they were doing when they were taking the mick out of the system and helping themselves to a bit of extra money and saying maybe five extra people came in for the eat out to help out scheme. And in fact, it was only one person who charged them five times. You know, there was a lot of that going on. Do we slightly forgive those people because they were extraordinary times? Have we changed that we don't want to call people out and report them? What happened there?
Well, it's perhaps a distinction to be made, isn't there, between, say, a small business with a handful of employees that took out a bounce back loan and that loan still wasn't enough to get them to recover from the pandemic. They went bust. They couldn't make the loan repayments. And so they defaulted on the loan. And that essentially just adds to the pile of government debt. But this,
yeah, that's not fraud, is it?
No,
there's no
exactly.
intent there. Yeah.
So this 11 billion is where there was intent, where there has been deliberate deception to obtain those sums fraudulently, and they have not been returned. So, you know, whether that was for, you know, very, you know, small beer sums on eat out to help out, whether it was a, you know, a taxi company, you know, not correctly stating its financial position in order to game the system a little bit. I think there's quite a lot of that in this data today. But they, you know, they are the, in individual cases, they're quite small. And it's a lot of small pieces making up to this 11 billion, which is quite different to the risks that we saw on the multi-billion pound spending on PPE and testing.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time this afternoon. Daniel Breese is the Chief Executive of the anti-corruption group Transparency International. Your thoughts on that? It's 0333 003 2353. They were such awful times. They were very strange times. I know that people who I didn't think would ever push the envelope a bit in terms of what they felt they might be able to get or were entitled to definitely did push the envelope during COVID times. Some of that, I think, was just people were driven by fear. How long is it going to last? Will the furlough scheme run out? You know, will my restaurant, whatever, ever open again? I think it was a very hazy horizon for our morality. But Daniel's last point is the one to hang on to. There's a whole heap of difference between that motivation and someone who goes, I've never made any PPE before and I'm going to go and make lots of PPE. And it might not help the people it's meant to be helping. We know that. It is 13 minutes to three.
Coming up, with flu cases expected to spike in the coming weeks, is it time to start wearing masks again? It's just gone 3:15. This is Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly, so must we. £50 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £50, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
NHS maternity units across the country are failing to provide safe care, with clinical teams often lacking empathy and leaving women feeling blamed or guilty. That's according to major new investigation. Baroness Amos, who's leading the inquiry, has said that nothing could have prepared her for the scale of the failings uncovered. Well, Rachel Ward, GP, is co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast, and we always welcome her expertise on the show. She joins us now. Rachel, it's quite an extraordinary, damning report that's come out. What are the key findings of what Baroness Amos has been investigating, and what are the issues being highlighted most urgently?
Good afternoon. So, yes, I mean, I think Baroness Amos, who's, as you say, is leading this investigation, you know, she uses words like nothing has prepared her for the scale of failures. And this is looking at both maternity care and neonatal care, so care of small babies after birth. And I think one of the incredible figures that has come out at this stage in this report is that over the last decade, there's been 750 recommendations to maternity care across the country. And so the question is, of course, why, with these recommendations, why have changes been so slow to occur? And why, you know, she is then questioning, why is it with these recommendations that it's still not possible that we are offering safe and reliable care everywhere? Now, we still don't, you know, it's still in relatively early stages, this review, and we are expecting interim findings to come out in February. I guess the thing for me is that with all of these previous reviews, what is going to be different this time? Mm. What is going to come out in this investigation that is actually going to change care? And, you know, I guess that's what we really are waiting for here.
And the inquiry so far, I mean, the investigation so far, what's come out, will make really quite worrying reading for a lot of expectant mothers. Is there anything in there that will be encouraging for people expecting a baby in terms of care and aftercare?
Look, I think it's a very worrying time when you're pregnant anyway. You know, it's a daunting prospect. And so I don't want to sound patronising in any way to expectant mothers. But what I would say is that we know that, you know, there are, you know, so many babies born in this country. In the vast majority of cases, everything is absolutely fine. Mm. And there are many, many good examples of care. Now, that, again, it's very difficult not to sound flippant in that situation, because when things go wrong, it is an absolute disaster. But I think what I would say to people who are facing, you know, having a baby, thinking, you know, what do I do? Communicate your wishes, communicate with the healthcare staff around you, and be honest about your concerns going forward.
Rachel, can I ask, does the inquiry give any indication as to how much of the problems that it is talking about come down to actual culture and leadership in maternity units, and how much is down to staffing pressures in hospitals or lack of resources?
I'm not aware of how much that at this stage, as I said, because the interim report will come out properly in February. But I know that when information from many different reviews of maternity care have previously come out, there have certainly been comments about culture. But I think the problem is, you know, you say about staffing levels, the problem is what tends to happen in these environments when you are under such incredible pressure of workforce pressures and, you know, constantly being understaffed, is that then breeds negative cultures. And unfortunately, you can enter this very negative spiral of behaviours and what an environment is like. But yeah, I think we really need to see what that unpicks when the report comes out in full.
Mm. The next story is all about the flu. Suggestion, it might be time to dust off COVID face masks once again, which I know all of us were so pleased to say goodbye of when the pandemic finally moved on. Flu cases are surging across the UK, and several hospitals have now reintroduced mask wearing for staff, patients and visitors to help reduce the spread. This is being described, Rachel, as the worst flu outbreak in decades, just as we're about to see another doctor strike. How concerned should we be?
So, you know, I say this every time. I think every year we have to remind people that flu is a serious disease. So thousands of people die from flu every year. I think we use the term flu incorrectly very frequently. People say they have flu when they've essentially got a cold. Mm. And so again, that adds to us being flippant about flu. But if you have influenza, it is very serious. And it can be serious for anyone, but in particular, serious for people who have chronic illness or are old or frail. So yes, this is worrying, because we know that we have a strain this year, which is managing to spread and kind of from, you know, one person to the next because of some mutations which it has developed. We know that Australia has just had a very bad winter, and we know that we tend to follow their trends. But also, we know that we've had really poor uptake with our flu vaccine this year. I think last week or so, there was only something like a 40% uptake of those eligible in London. So it's really, really low. So we kind of have a perfect storm with this situation. But it's not too late to act. You know, we are still really urging people to come forward for their flu jab if they're eligible on the NHS. Or as I heard somebody, one of the interviews on the radio earlier say, you know, if you go out and buy a flu jab for about £15, it's probably the best investment you're going to make this winter.
And how effective is mask wearing when it comes to the spread of flu?
So we've always known that if you are wearing a mask, the main protection you are offering is to those around you. That gives better protection than protecting yourself. I think people took a bit of getting their head around that idea during COVID times. It was for those around you. It does offer some protection both ways. It certainly is not completely fail-safe. You know, but if you are... You know, it depends on other factors as well. If you're outside, if you're inside in number of people in a room, the way that people are speaking, shouting, etc. There's many factors, but it can reduce spread for sure.
And now for a good news story. A pioneering new treatment has successfully reversed aggressive and previously incurable blood cancers in a number of patients taking part in a groundbreaking clinical trial
Tell us about this, Rachel.
Yeah, so a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about amazing treatment for a B-cell leukemia. And then this is another incredible story about T-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia. As I discussed last time, leukemia is a very, very complex set of diseases. It is not one disease. Now, this is a technique which has been developed and it's been trialed on people who have not responded to chemo and bone marrow transplant. And at that stage, really kind of, you know, approaching, you know, end of life approach. So this has been groundbreaking that out of the people that have entered this trial, and the first person was in 2022 in Great Ormond Street, almost two thirds have gone into remission. And the first child that had the treatment in 2022 is still in remission and living very well. It's an incredibly, you know, mind-blowingly complex treatment when you talk about the genetics of it. You know, they are essentially changing bases in your DNA to, you know, manipulate your T cells to give them essentially superpowers to not only survive, you know, chemo, but also to then attack cancer cells. Such incredible science. I can't even, you know, imagine how it was developed. But it's an intensive therapy for those who undergo it, but some really, really positive findings.
And Rachel, will it be available, widely available to people on the NHS, or is it a very expensive treatment?
Well, I know that so far, you know, there's been another 10 people who have undergone this treatment. I don't know what the rollout is as to who that will be. As I say, it is at this stage, it's for people who have not responded to standard treatment. And it is a very intensive process. So I don't know the exact criteria for who, you know, meets that criteria to undergo it. But let's hope that it is expanded with more positive outcomes.
Well, that's a very positive breakthrough. That is Rachel Ward, GP and the co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast.
Are you wearing a mask again on public transport?
No, but I've seen a lot more people wearing masks, both in just on the tube and in shops.
Yeah, I'm wearing mine.
Are you?
I am, yep. I don't see the point in not. What's the point of not wearing one?
I just can't. It's that revisiting that memory of COVID. I just don't want to go back there.
Well, exactly. And we're less likely to go back there if we all wear a mask. I don't get it, people. I don't get it. This one comes in from, I'm going to say your name is Ulysses, but it might be the name of your business. I'm a fit and healthy 54 years old, ready to pay for the jab, but being told there aren't any vaccines available in my region, which is Lincolnshire. Well, that is sad to know. I guess you might have run out in Lincolnshire, you might have to travel.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
And obviously wear a mask if you do. That takes us to 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Ryan Nika on Times Radio. Coming up, Donald Trump says Europe is a collection of decaying countries with weak leaders. Oh, you're so lovely. Why can't many children who've left care get their records? And our big interview is with the best-selling author Sebastian Foulkes. Let's get the news first with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Britain's top spy in the IRA was pampered, protected and paid hundreds of thousands of pounds by MI5 agents, all while he was involved in abductions and murders during the Troubles. The final report of Operation Kenova has been published into the crimes of Steak Knife and the complicity of his handlers. He's widely been identified as Freddie Scappaticci, although he denied that until his death 2 years ago. The Times' chief reporter, Sean O'Neill, describes how he was treated.
It was a dedicated army intelligence unit set up to look after him. MI5 agents were embedded in that unit. He had access to a 24-hour dedicated phone line he could call at any time. And he was lavished with hundreds of thousands of pounds in the end. And it was felt by those handling him that he was invaluable. He was described as the golden egg of British intelligence.
The UK government has been urged to publicly name Steak Knife. Donald Trump has criticised European leaders, calling them weak. In an interview with Politico, the US president accused Ukraine's allies of talking too much and not delivering. US Ambassador Warren Stevens is visiting Downing Street today. Number 10 has declined to say whether Keir Starmer agrees with Trump's description of Europe as a group of decaying nations. England's former children's commissioner has been appointed chair of the grooming gangs inquiry. After months of delays, Baroness Baroness Anne Longfield's been drafted in to lead the review. It'll take 3 years and she'll have a budget of £65 million. Shabana Mahmood says she's the right person for the job.
She has devoted her life to children's rights, including running a charity supporting and protecting young people and working for prime ministers of different political parties.
Baroness Longfield vowed not to shy away from difficult or uncomfortable truths. Fraudsters taking advantage of COVID-19 support schemes cost the taxpayer nearly £11 billion. The COVID Counter-Fraud Commissioner, Tom Hayhoe, has told Parliament programmes including furlough wage subsidies and the Eat Out to Help Out scheme were a golden opportunity to fraudsters. James Hurley is the Assistant Business Editor at The Times.
Looking at between sort of 5 and 10%. Error and fraud rates on some of these programmes. So it's absolutely huge. If I take the bounce back scheme as an example, all you had to do to get a bounce back loan was essentially fill a form out. That's it. There were no checks. So, I mean, you know, it's once you realise that, it's pretty obvious that this thing is going to be targeted by fraudsters. And indeed, that's what happened.
Flights and trains have been cancelled and hundreds of properties left without power because of Storm Bram. Heavy rainfall and strong winds are expected to cause disruption across parts of the UK today and into tomorrow. The Met Office has issued amber and yellow weather warnings for rain and wind amid warnings of floods and flying debris in some areas. And for News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It is 3 minutes past three. It's Rory Nika and Fee Glover with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon.
The EU says it's very close to agreement on using £100 billion worth of frozen Russian assets to support Ukraine after months of negotiations. That news breaking in the last half hour. Well, Ukraine itself hopes to present a reworked peace plan to the White House today, following meetings with European allies. But it comes as Donald Trump launches an attack on the very same countries that helped revise that plan. And in an interview this morning, the American president described Europe as a collection of decaying nations led badly.
I think they're weak, but I also think that they want to be so politically correct that I think they don't know what to do. Europe doesn't know what to do. They don't know what to do on trade either. I mean, I look at a lot of the trade, you know, situation that's going on over there. It's a little bit dangerous. But Europe, they want to be politically correct, and it makes them weak. That's what makes them weak.
That was Donald Trump speaking to Politico. In a moment, we'll speak about those frozen Russian assets with the political economist and former EU Commission advisor, Philippe Legrain. But first, let's go to the Times' Ukraine correspondent, Maxim Tucker. Maxim, hi there. What do we know about this revised peace plan?
So obviously the crucial point is that Ukraine is not prepared to give away any land. It's not prepared to give away this fortress belt in the Donbass, which Russia has been trying to take for the past 11 years and obviously more actively since the full-scale invasion. I think obviously we can expect that Ukraine doesn't want to see these $100 billion in frozen assets going into joint US and Russian ventures. So it wants to keep those going to Ukraine. And I think we don't know very much about what the rest of the document will involve, but Zelensky says that he has stripped out the anti-Ukrainian elements.
Well, I mean, given that Zelensky is heavily involved in this, as you'd expect him to be, what chance that Russia's actually going to be at all interested in this revised deal?
Well, I think the Russians aren't going to be interested in any peace deal as long as they think the war is going in their favour, as long as they keep gaining land militarily. But they do have to play along to a certain extent with Donald Trump because they don't want to alienate him to the extent that he decides to renew military aid support to Ukraine. They don't want him to look a fool and do something like that. And they also need to make sure that Donald Trump is able to blame the Ukrainians and walk away from this peace deal, walk away from supporting Ukraine altogether.
You're going to be talking a little bit more about your reporting from the territories with John Pienaar. He's mentioned that on Drive Time. But why is Zelensky refusing to hand any land over at all?
Well, this is the fortress belt. I mean, it's home to 350,000 Ukrainians. So you're talking about giving 350,000 Ukrainian homes to Russians to make sure they live under occupation, which is something I think no Ukrainian leader wants to do. But it's also the best fortified part of Ukraine. It's a series of four major cities along a major highway and several towns which have been fortified over the last 11 years. And it is the best place where Ukraine can hold the Russians back. If the Russians gain access or gain control of the full amount of the fortress belt, they have an amazing launch pad to attack north into the Kharkiv region or west into the Dnipro region, which are home to Ukraine's second and fourth largest cities.
And as the war drags on and on, what is the actual state of the front line? Is there still very much the feeling, Maxim, that Russia has the upper hand at the moment on the front line?
Well, Russia does have the upper hand on the front line in that it's got momentum and it's moving forward, and Ukraine is constantly having to react and firefight in different places. But it is only taking very small swathes of territory, and it's losing an incredible amount of infantry as it does so. It's really astonishing the number of lives that are being lost for incremental gains. And of course, Putin seems happy to accept those losses as he creeps forward. But, I mean, there's a lot still that Europe and the US could do to increase the cost of Putin's invasion of Ukraine.
Thank you, Maxim. That's Maxim Tucker, The Times' Ukraine correspondent. Now, turning to Europe, let's bring in the political economist Philippe Legrain, who advised European Commissioner President José Manuel Barroso. Philippe, thanks so much for joining us. How significant is this closeness to agreement, do you think?
I think this is extremely important. Ukraine is about to run out of money sometime early next year. The US under Donald Trump is no longer willing to help support it. Therefore, it is down to Europe, which means the EU plus the UK plus perhaps Canada and Australia to step in. And obviously, the EU is the biggest player there. All the action is about how to make use of roughly 210 billion euros worth of frozen Russian assets. That's about 185 billion pounds, most of which is in Belgium. And the EU has come up with plan after plan to try and make use of them. And there are two sets of objectives. The first is Hungary. Its Prime Minister Viktor Orban is pro-Putin and doesn't want to see any more money go to Ukraine. And the second is Belgium, because Belgium is where most of the frozen assets are located. And they're worried that if the whole scheme unravels, that they'll be on the hook for all this money. And they want guarantees from other EU countries that that won't be the case.
Did you say, Philippe, that most of that money that could be unfrozen assets-wise is in Belgium?
That's correct, yeah. It's 185 billion.
What's it all doing in Belgium?
Okay, there is what's called a central securities depository, which is like basically a custodian for financial assets called Euroclear. It's the biggest international one in the world. There are roughly 42 trillion euros worth of assets there. And roughly 185 billion are frozen Russian assets, which were basically reserves of the Central Bank of Russia that were frozen after the invasion of Ukraine in 2022.
How much of a game changer would it be for Zelensky in Ukraine if those assets were unfrozen and, you know, channeled towards Ukraine, whether that's efforts in the war or redevelopment sort of after the war? How big a deal would that be for Ukraine's efforts?
I think it would be extremely important. At the moment, you know, as I said, first of all, Ukraine can no longer rely on the US. Second of all, Ukraine is living hand to mouth. It's surviving on drips and drabs of aid. Here, if you say we're going to commit this big amount of money for multi-year financial and military support, that gives Ukraine the security to stand its ground. Also, it raises the cost to Vladimir Putin. Putin is counting on ultimately Europeans folding. Like Donald Trump, he thinks that Europeans are weak. So it would raise the cost to Putin. Also, it would stop Donald Trump getting his hands on the assets. In the 28-point deal that he tried to float recently, that involved earmarking those assets frozen in Europe for joint investment schemes for his cronies and that of Vladimir Putin. And last but not least, it would ensure that if there are proper peace negotiations, that the EU has to be at the table, because obviously it has all these frozen assets which Russia wants to get back.
We played the clip earlier, Philippe, of Donald Trump saying some pretty, you know, not very friendly things to European leaders, criticising them about trade, criticising the way they're going about trying to negotiate this peace deal. How can Europe respond to this attack, and how do you think it will, given we continue to see so many European leaders do their very best to cozy up to Donald Trump, regardless of what he says about them?
Well, yeah, I think Europe, and I mean both the EU and the UK, are in a mess because we are defensively weak and we're reliant on the United States for our security at a time when there is a war in Ukraine that threatens to spread further if Ukraine doesn't hold the line, and indeed is spreading further with Russian hybrid attacks, things like cyber attacks, sabotage, arson, assassination of political enemies, including in the UK, and so on. So the EU, Europe is in a very weak position. And you know, the warning signs that America wanted to disengage from Europe have been there for a while, and Europeans have had their head in the sand. Also, public finances are strained. We know that in this country. It's also true in France and elsewhere. People don't want to spend more in defence. And the result is that, you know, we're in a very difficult position, which is why we're trying to resort to using these frozen assets as a preference to borrowing the money through government means, which would be another way to do it.
I mean, do you think European leaders will take any comfort in the fact that Donald Trump is still engaging in this issue, even though he's having a go at them? I mean, there was a suggestion a few months ago that, you know, he was just felt he hadn't been able to get the quick win, the quick peace deal he wanted. You know, he triumphed his peace deal in the Middle East. It wasn't happening, getting a peace deal between Putin and Zelensky. At least he is still engaging in this conflict and trying to get broker a peace deal.
Well, yeah, it depends what kind of peace deal. I think, obviously, he is mercurial. He's all over the place. One minute he is pro-Putin, the other time, minute he's a bit more pro-Zelensky. Sometimes he loves Europe, and other times he hates it or despises it. So yeah, I don't think you can rely on him either way. I think that the way forward for Europeans together is to wake up and say, you know, we need to try and keep Trump as engaged as possible for as long as possible. At the same time, we need to be ready to chart our own course. And that means massively increasing defence spending, as Poland has done, and indeed as Germany is doing, and we in Britain and in France, that is not happening yet. It means, therefore, providing Ukraine with the help that it needs. And only then will be able to stand up to Trump on trade and other issues.
That is Philippe Legrain, who advised the European Commissioner, President José Manuel Barroso. Thank you.
Now, Jane has got a comment. If European leaders are weak, what is Trump when he keels over and purrs like a kitten after every meeting with Putin? Well, Jane, sometimes I think, and I don't think I'm alone in this at all, if these were children, we'd tell them to stop behaving in such a weird and silly way, wouldn't we? But they're grown men. And we watch from the sidelines going, yes, that's diplomacy. Yes, he needs to do that. But it's still quite strange. Strange characteristics on display. Coming up after 3:30, we are going to delight your ears with an interview that Roya has done with Sebastian Folks. Now, do you say Forks, Folks, Fuchs?
It's Folks. It's definitely Folks. And if you ever call him Forks, he gets very cross.
I've been told, on his memoir, Fires Which Burnt Brightly. That will also go into our podcast, Off Air with Jane and Fee, where we always have the big daily interview and loads of other stuff. At the moment, we are currently discussing what's wrong with all of those property shows which are on television at about 5 o'clock. There's one at the moment being sported by Channel 4 where a couple can win a bed and breakfast in France. But why are they serving very hot curry to their guests in the Dordogne? So other 3:30 interviews in full include Susie Dent, Chris Van Tulleken, Sally Wainwright. And last week I spoke to Aline van der Velden, who is the creator of the first AI actress, Tilly Norwood. I asked her about the concern from people in creative industries who are seriously worried about losing their jobs.
So we are hiring AI DOPs that work with the AI to be a director of photography. So jobs will change. I really, really strongly believe that because I'm seeing this, and we've been in this for 3 years now. Look, some jobs will change. I'm not going to deny that whatsoever. But I think if people upskill, they're less likely to be at the threat of this. And there are huge opportunities for people who are AI literate. And at the same time, some of these traditional jobs will remain. You know, I really think people still want real people. It's boring to only have AI.
Well, as we were told to never say in BBC local radio, people had a mixed reaction to that interview. If you'd like to get your ears around that, you can download the podcast. There are about 7,634 real-life episodes you can choose from. Coming up, your whole childhood in a box of disorganised, incomplete files. We're going to talk to the care leaver who tried to find her records when she was in her 50s and was given a box that was disappointing, heavily redacted, and probably meant that she didn't, within her sister's lifetime, get to meet her siblings. You're listening to Fee Glover and Roy Anika on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrand and Patrick Maguire as they take a deep dive into the latest Westminster wrangles, reveal insider conversations and bring you intelligent analysis, authority and insight.
What happens now? What happens today? What happens tomorrow?
No party loyalty, no spin. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective, the curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote and the remarkable on spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Co-op members now get prices matched to Aldi. Hold on, no way. Okay then, so co-op members now get everyday essentials price matched to Aldi. Sign up and start saving. Co-op, owned by you, right by you. I wasn't expecting that.
Co-op member prices matched versus comparable selected products at Aldi GB. Co-op membership required. Co-op group food stores only. See co-op.co.uk/Aldi price match.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
Here's an exciting competition on Times Radio in association with Thomas Fudge's, who makes some of Britain's finest biscuits. This Christmas, you could celebrate the season in style with a Yuletide trip you'll never forget. We're giving you the chance to win an enchanting three-night Christmas getaway for two in either Vienna, Prague or Copenhagen. This delicious experience includes flights, luxury hotel accommodation, dinner and £500 spending money. For your chance to win something extra special, thanks to Thomas Fudge's excellent biscuits, simply go online and search for Times Radio Competitions. You'll find the entry form on our website. One entrant will be selected at random from all valid entries, and the competition closes at midnight on Sunday, December the 14th. All the terms and conditions are online. Good luck!
I second that. It is 19 minutes past three. The data protection regulator has promised to take legal action against local authorities who breach the law on returning records to those leaving the care system. The information commissioner has raised the alarm at what he calls the lengthy, traumatic and often demoralising process people face to access their own care records, which can take up to 16 years, with the records often being lost, damaged or heavily redacted. Well, earlier today, I spoke to Jackie McCartney, who spent 13 years in care when she was young. She's now an ambassador for the Rees Foundation, and she accessed her care records aged 50, having waited until her own children were old enough to understand her past.
Considering I spent 13 years in residential care back in the 70s and 80s, I haven't actually got a lot of records, considering I spent 13 years in there. And then the information I've got, yeah, is also very heavily redacted, has lots of missing pieces. And you're not given any genuine answers as to why that happened. Mine was back in the 70s and 80s. So, you know, I'd left care in 1983. I've learned and I've had to understand that I had a joint file with a sibling I'd gone into care with. So apparently a lot of the redaction was to do with my sibling, because that's third party information. Yet that's my sibling that I'd gone into care with, that I'd been in care with, and her information was redacted, but she's my sibling. And that's really hard. And then when you read some of the things that were written about you as a child, it's very hard to digest. and nobody gives you answers. For me, I was given this box. I was told if I needed anything to get back in touch with them. But the social worker at the time was like, oh, well, there's not really a lot in there. I've had a look through it, so don't worry about it. And that statement literally shut down any sort of conversation I ever could have had or picking up the phone, because it was some person I didn't know and I had no relationship with had got to decide what I could or I couldn't see, and that she was a total stranger that knew more about me and my life than I knew and that I was ever likely to find out, because she decided what I could or I couldn't see. And that, even 9 years later, is still extremely hard to understand and digest, why somebody knows more about me and I don't.
Yep, for sure. Can we talk just a little bit more about that redaction as well, Jackie? I mean, who does the redaction? And once the information has been redacted, is there any other place that you can go to find the original document that would allow you more information?
It was a social worker. So again, I'd left care in 1983 as a 16-year-old. At 50, I went to access my care records and I was told I'd have to be allocated a social worker to check, you know, that emotionally and mentally that I was okay to get my care records, which was a bit frustrating because I'd gone all those years that the system didn't care where I was and now all of a sudden wanted to check I was okay. And it was this social worker that redacted them. I think they worked in partnership with, they have like a legal department within the local authority that went through it with them. And I can only say, you know, it's like they redact, if they don't understand, they redact it just in case. And that's how it felt. But I feel like I'm sitting here now, you know, with more blank pages and more questions that I'm actually never, ever going to get the answer to. As far as I know, that's all they found for me. That's all that there is there. Because, again, we're going back to, you know, the 70s and 80s. My records are a paper version. So they would have been in a box. They would have been in archive storage somewhere. And it's just hard because it's like, I feel like now, you know, I'm 59 and it's a bit like I'm never going to get those answers. So I have to park it.
Yeah.
But what I can do is do something like this and get on the back of this campaign, you know, for better records campaign with ICO, that hopefully in the future somebody going through the care system or somebody looking for answers now will be treated better and understood more as to why it's so important to us.
Well, I think you've explained your situation so brilliantly, Jackie, that frustration of knowing that now you won't be able to have those questions answered is such a horrible one to have. But I wonder whether you do genuinely feel positive about the future for the care leaver, you know, 20 years down the line. You know, will their story be different? Does it make a huge difference that we've got digital records now, not papers in shoeboxes that can get lost or filed?
I would hope that we now have a digital footprint, but I think there's lots of stories about people that are in different foster placements, different residential care, but there doesn't seem to be no collective that those... What happens to those foster care or residential care children's records? You know, should they be handed back to the local authority? Because at the end of the day, the local authority is the overriding corporate parent to keep them safe and understand how precious they are, trying to get those answers. Instead of us, like I found a document from the NSPCC and it was me individually having to approach the NSPCC to say, oh, I found this document. You were involved in me coming into care. Have you got anything? And they had absolutely nothing of me. So all I had were these two pages, and yet there was nothing. But they were the people that removed me from my biological family, and they were the people that put me into the care system.
Right, but they can provide you with no answers about that decision and that
nothing
process.
They only kept records, I think, back in my time for 5-7 years, and they didn't keep any records beyond that. I approached the NHS for my medical records, and what came about. And my actual own GP was very supportive because I explained to her I wasn't looking for the records to complain about my practice. I was looking for my records because I wanted to know my journey in life and my medical history. And all my medical records had been destroyed prior to 2001. And again, nobody can tell me why, who made that decision, and why did it happen? So again, lots of blank pages. And as a 59-year-old, when you're asked the question, do you have any, you know, family history medical-wise? I have nothing. And actually, you destroyed it all anyway.
Can you just explain to us a little bit more about the other frustrations that you now feel? Is one of them, Jackie, that actually, if you had tried to find your records earlier, you might have been more successful?
I don't know whether I would have been more successful. There's very much a standard, lots of people that have tried to access the records. It's a bit like, oh, your records were before we went digital, the paper versions, you know, they got lost in a fire, they were water damaged, we've got no trace of you. And I don't know whether that answer is just an answer to get rid of us, or whether that is a genuine answer, because again, I can only question mark that, not knowing whether that is the truth or it's not the truth. Yeah. But a lot of people get told that sentence
You can see, I mean, I'm not excusing it at all, but you can see what might have happened, can't you? That somebody thinks, oh, well, you know, that person hasn't come looking for any answers, and, you know, they would now be in their late 30s or 40s or 50s. So, you know, we'll just bin it. I mean, it's a carelessness that has cost you so much, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think there is part of that, you know, a 50-year-old going looking for answers. But I was also a 50-year-old with now a family of my own that were asking me questions that I couldn't answer for them. And that's why I went looking for those records, to try and give my own children and grandchild those kind of answers as to why I don't have a mum and dad, why I don't have a family. And we can piece together some bits of it, but there's some bits we're never, ever, ever going to get answers to.
So,
you know, things like my sibling's stuff was redacted. Well, me and my sibling, I'm one of nine. Only two of us went into care, and the care system separated me and my sibling. But I'm never going to know why that decision was made, because that's all been redacted, because it's my sister's information. My sister has since passed. I'm never going to get those answers, and I either have to get angry, bitter or twisted, or I have to do, which is what I have done, chosen this path, which is my journey's not going to change, but please can we change it for those people following behind me, that it gets better and that it has improved and will improve more than it has done so far, because there's too many people out there looking for answers that are not getting them.
And Jackie, did you meet your sister before she passed?
No.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
No, that's a big thing. That is a massive thing. You've told your story so beautifully, Jackie, and we really, really appreciate you shining a light on this for us. Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon.
No problem at all. My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that was Jackie McCartney from the Rees Foundation, which works on behalf of care leavers. I think what is so clear in her story are the real life consequences of all of that lack of attention that's been paid to the documents that could help people live such a happier life after they've left care. Helen agrees and says, gaps and inaccuracies in files are still happening today. Adoptive parents trying to get information, e.g. medical, are constantly thwarted. There are still more questions than answers. And the Information Commissioner, John Edwards, will be on John Pienaar's programme on Drive a little later on this afternoon.
Coming up, our interview with the best-selling novelist Sebastian Foakes. But first, let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Laura Kirk.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. MI5's initial failure to disclose all it knew about the Army's top spy in the provisional IRA during the Troubles was significant. Those are the findings of an independent report into the activities of Stake Knife. The UK government has been urged to name Stake Knife, who's widely believed to be the West Belfast man, Freddie Scapaticci, who died in 2023. Former Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Julian Smith, sympathises with the victims, but says this is a complicated issue.
I realise there's frustration with the government, with the state for the naming issue, but having kind of worked very closely on security matters in Northern Ireland, I just think, you know, national security, protecting those that are helping with national security, it is a really difficult balance. But I really feel for victims of these horrendous crimes that, you know, have read this report today.
England's former Children's Commissioner, Baroness Anne Longfield, has been appointed chair of the Grooming Gangs Inquiry. After months of delay, she'll now lead the three-year review with a budget of £65 million. Thousands of people are without power. Storm Bram brings heavy rain and strong winds across the UK. Most outages are in southwestern and central England and Wales. The Met Office has issued weather alerts for much of the country. Dozens of flood warnings have been issued across Britain. Reports found taxpayers lost almost £11 billion due to fraud and error in COVID support schemes. It says rushed programmes such as Eat Out to Help Out and furlough created major weaknesses. Pope Leo has repeated his call for a just and lasting peace in Ukraine. He's met Volodymyr Zelensky in Rome after the Ukrainian president held talks with European leaders in Downing Street yesterday. And a nationwide ban on under-16s using social media has come into force in Australia. Large platforms now face hefty fines if they fail to block children from accessing their services. And for News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
This is Times Radio.
I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year, we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles, whether it's your first home or your forever home. Find your dream kitchen at Wickes. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free kitchen design appointment today at wickes.co.uk.
Sebastian Foulkes is one of this country's most acclaimed authors, best known for his sweeping wartime novels Birdsong and Charlotte Grey. He's also written a James Bond book and a Jeeves in Worcester comedy. But now, somewhat reluctantly, he's written about himself. Fires Which Burn Brightly, A Life in Progress is a new collection of 10 essays charting Sebastian's life experiences. I first asked him why he decided to write a memoir now.
I was reluctant because I just always think that somebody writing a memoir sounds rather self-important. also, most memoirs are just so boring. There's very few I've read which are any good. There's always that terrible sentence which begins something like, my paternal grandfather, on the other hand, and, you know, the book falls from your lifeless fingers at that point. So what I've tried to do is I put together 10 different essays on things which have meant a lot to me, things I've been passionate about, cared about, lived through, and they're sort of separate, and they're all essays with themes, and what they have in common is they're all, I'm the narrator in all of them, and they are partly about me. So it is really a memoir, but it's a memoir without the boring bits.
And in terms of sort of timing, I mean, when I was reading the book, and there was a line that absolutely jumped off the page to me in the foreword, which is you saying that at some point after the pandemic, you realised that people of a younger generation were struggling to understand what you were saying.
it was as if the stars by which it always steered now belonged to a different sky. What did you mean by that in terms of it being a motivation to write this now?
Well, I think two things. One, I think the pandemic was a big deal and the way we lived and changed the way we live. And there's a slight sort of revisionist thing going on at the moment, which I find quite annoying, about people saying, oh, I love lockdown, I had a great time. You know, you're mad to have had a great time, you know, with people dying all around you and ambulances screaming up the road and not able to see anyone. But it did make me think a lot about, the meanings of friendship. And this book is a lot about friends and friendship as well as just about me. But I think that next year is going to be this big year of reading, because no young people seem to read books anymore. And the charity that I'm a chair of, the Charlotte Aitken Trust, we're hoping to do something, a big project with schools next year as part of this. But I was, I think, in my immediate world of publishing, writing, a lot of people left or were fired or resigned or retired during the pandemic, and it was difficult to pick up again. And when I was talking to sort of younger, newer colleagues, they didn't really seem to have read very much, anything really. And I've had conversations with people about all sorts of literary things, and there is a sort of fundamental failure to understand even the most elementary things, you know, like what is the difference between a novel and a factual book. Some people of a younger generation seem to think that novel is just another word for book.
Mm.
I had a long conversation with someone who runs an art gallery who'd very kindly credited a biography I'd written called The Fatal Englishman, because one of the sections of that is about a painter called Christopher Wood. And in the catalogue to the gallery, she said, and also Sebastian Foulkes's novel, The Fatal Englishman. So I wrote a very friendly, polite letter saying, F, for your information, it's actually it's a biography, not a novel. And we had a bit of a to and fro, and eventually it became clear to me that this person just didn't understand the difference. You know, I think that most people go through their lives thinking that everything that happens to them is normal. And one of the ways we have of surviving as a species is to normalize everything. And that's how we get through things. But I think I'd come to realize that my life had been a bit less normal than I'd thought and had now become a bit of a sort of antique, a bit of a curio. I mean, I am someone whose understanding of life is built as much by what I've read as by what I've actually experienced. My understanding of people is based much more on Henry James and Jane Austen than it is on chatting to the neighbour over the fence. There won't be anyone like me again.
I don't.
And maybe that's a good thing, Roy.
No. I mean, on that point, Sebastian, you are a passionate advocate for reading more, particularly with young people. You've touched on what you're doing with your charity's work. You're a big supporter of the Queen's Reading Room. Of course, Camilla is a huge advocate for encouraging more people to pick up books, particularly young people. What do you think is being lost by young people not reading enough? I mean, what's at risk if more young people don't turn to books?
I think that if you haven't read, several hundred books, your understanding of what it is to be alive is critically limited. And you can see this in the speeches of politicians who haven't read anything, and celebrity reality TV show people. They really struggle to deal with life except in the most infantile terms. How can you possibly deal with questions of mortality, philosophy, kindness, how to live your life, how to understand other people, how to navigate your way in the world, if you haven't read Middlemarch?
Mm. You mentioned just then that you realised in coming to write this book that perhaps your life hadn't been quite as normal as you had previously thought. And I want to sort of touch on the issue of mental health, which, you know, you've written about a lot, you write about in this book, you explore in huge detail in Human Traces. It is a thread that runs through this book. You describe what you describe as a minor breakdown at Cambridge. I wanted to start by asking you on that sort of theme, why is it you think we don't talk enough? Why is there still such stigma around mental health?
Well, I think we talk far too much about it, actually. But I think mental illness actually is, but I don't know why, when did we stop calling it mental illness and start calling it mental health, by the way? That's a bit of a footnote. I think there's, the whole thing's gone completely out of proportion, and half the world is signed off sick because they're feeling sad, and that's a terrible thing. And 21-year-olds who are finding it difficult to find a way in the world don't need to have a label slapped on them and to be stuck on benefits forever. They need a hand around the shoulder, and they need sometimes a kick up the backside. They need friends, they need parents, they need help and chat, and to try harder, some of them. Of course, then there is the matter of serious mental illness, which is, that's a different matter altogether, and that is a dark and difficult subject, which, as you said, I looked into the beginnings of psychiatry in Human Traces, and it's not, and there's an essay in Where My Heart Used to Beat, which is called Sand in the Gears, which looks at the whole issue of why human beings are so mentally frail, why we seem to go wrong so much. And, you know, I go into a lot of detail there, which I can't go into here. But essentially, I think it's to do with the way that we have evolved, and why we're like cars, you know. Cars, the axles are fine, the camshaft is fine, the pistons work fine, but the new electronic warning systems are truly terrible. My car bleeps at me all the time, telling me this, that, and the other, and sometimes it's right and sometimes it's wrong. But this is the latest stuff that's come into your car, and it's rather like that with human beings.
Mm.
You know, the legs and arms and stuff, the liver and the lungs seem to work pretty well on the whole. But, you know, the sort of the last thing to come in, human consciousness, this thing that differentiates us from all other creatures, that is not really firmly bedded in yet. And it is fragile and it is frail.
You write about your breakdown at Cambridge in the 1970s. Can you just talk a little bit about what that was like as a young man, when presumably not a lot of people were understanding of what mental illness was in the 1970s, and people probably didn't talk about that much? Was that a pretty frightening experience?
Yeah, well, as I say in the book, you know, the thing about a lot of illnesses is that you can have quite florid and unpleasant symptoms, but the underlying condition is really not very is not very severe. So, I mean, I was just having some sort of difficulties adjusting to the grown-up world, I suppose. And it doesn't help if you drink a lot of alcohol and take a lot of drugs. So I would specifically say to parents of 19 and 20-year-olds, don't let them smoke genetically modified skunk, because that is a sure way of screwing up their brains. It was difficult, but, you know, people go through difficult times, and I got over it pretty quickly. And I've been, you know, absolutely right as rain for decades.
There's a lot in the book about family and how your, you know, your relationships with your family, how family has shaped you. How important has your family been in terms of your writing and what you've come to write about?
Completely unimportant, I would say, because I don't really write in an autobiographical way. But I think what my family did, for which I am very grateful, was that they were there. And I had two parents at home, two very nice, loving, kind parents. And they gave me stability, and they gave me books to read, and they cared about education, and so on. And they were a constant sort of stabilizing, kindly influence, as parents ought to be, but, you know, all too seldom are.
Mm.
And I have an elder brother who was a great playmate when we were young and great friend when we were older. I mean, I played tennis with him only 2 days ago, actually. So they're very, very important in the sense of background stability and friendship and laughter. But in terms of what I've actually written in fiction, I mean, that's all from a different place completely.
Very interesting sort of descriptions of your time at school, Elstree, and then Wellington, which certainly shaped you in many ways. I don't get the sense that you particularly enjoyed either from the essays in the book. Those schools are both still around now. I mean, what's your take on the fact that parents are still sending their children away to boarding schools?
Oh, well, they've changed completely. You know, I was at school in the 1960s, and, you know, it's a different world. These schools have the same names, but they're completely unrecognisable. You know, Wellington College, when I was there in the 60s, was a very second-rate school, rather anarchic, very badly run, second-rate academically. It is now an absolute beacon of what a private school can be. It's co-ed, it's highest quality academically, it has all sorts of partnerships and outreach, it has schools in China and the Far East. It's a sort of example of how, you know, modern education can be. But it's just bad luck that, you know, I was there when it was an absolute pit. And Elstree School, the little school I went to before that, is a marvellous school. I was at a carol service with the choir from that school a few days ago. And again, it's co-ed and boarding is entirely optional. The kids don't have to board. They just long to go to board because then they have sort of Saturday night feasts and videos and so on. So it's all changed. But, you know, you can't complain about the time in which you were born, because basically a lot of what Fires Which Burn Brightly is about is my parents' generation, that wartime generation, what they put up with, what they went through in order that their children, i.e. people like of my age, born in the 50s and 60s, that how we could prosper and benefit from what they went through. And by and large, being born in what the so-called baby boom generation has been an absolute blessing. You know, my grandfather fought in the First World War, my father in the Second. But my brother and I managed to skip the Third World War because it didn't come. And finally, in this country, in the 80s and 90s, there was actually some money. I mean, not much and not for long, but a little bit before the bankers and the hedge funds had trousered it all in 2007. But, you know, so my parents never had any money. That generation, they never did. They were taxed at 90%, as well as carrying all their war wounds. So I can't complain that I was bad. It was unfortunate timing in my school days, when the rest of my life has been the most incredibly good fortune in timing.
You've sat on government committees about commemorating and remembering what you mentioned the wartime generation went through and war. Do you think there's a risk that younger people, not only through not reading, but just the younger generations, have forgotten what that generation endured?
No, I don't think so, really. I think that the commemoration of the First World War, the centenary, was really well done, very well handled, and I was really pleased to play a tiny part in that on the government advisory group, particularly the Battle of the Somme in 2016, the centenary of that, for which I wrote the narrative of the service, and I wrote a speech that was given by Prince William. It was great, and I do think the government got all that right, and I think the ceremonies were good, and I think there was an enormous amount of research, anyway, into how much younger people, schools and universities and so on, had increased their understanding of at least what took place in 1914-18. And I think likewise with D-Day and the Second World War, I think the fact that our children are taught so little history because it was removed from the core curriculum by Tony Blair, I think, is a disaster. But the little thing that remains on is very much the Second World War, and I think maybe Henry VIII. Well, I think everything else has gone, hasn't it? But I think those memories are being very well looked after at the moment.
I mean, war is something that you have written about in several of your books. I have to ask about Birdsong, a book that I first came across at school and studied at school, and it has touched so many people. I'm sure so many of our listeners will have read it. When you have written a book like Birdsong and you have a book like Birdsong in your back catalogue, is it a relief to have something like that that's always there, or does it hang over as a slight expectation? People are always expecting you to kind of write something even bigger.
No, I like having it there. There was a lovely 30th anniversary edition brought out by my publisher, which really looked wonderful, and I turned around, you know, reading from it and talking to people. I sometimes think it's a bit like a train, and you need a locomotive as well as new carriages and dining cars and all sorts of fancy bits and pieces, but, you know, you need an engine to do the shunting and the pulling and the pushing. And if Birdsong has performed that function in all the books I've written, it's the one that people have come back to, it's the one that sold the most copies, that's completely fine by me. You know, it's quite good, really, I think. You know, I haven't read it for a bit, but last time I looked at it, it seemed to be okay, seemed to hold up all right.
It's pretty good.
Fires Which Burn Brightly, with the book that, you know, the memoir I've just finished, is, I mean, we've talked a lot about war and madness, and it's quite, it's meant to be funny, Roya. I hope you did have the odd laugh.
I laugh in a lot of your books. Don't you worry.
As you get older, one of the things you realise is how life is, you know, is full of terrible disasters, and I despair of human nature, but it is basically absurd. It is funny. And one of the ways I've sort of got through my own life is this sort of dichotomy, if you like. It's concentrating very furiously, very seriously and very hard on the work, but treating myself as a bit of a joke, which is, I think people who don't realise that they are a bit of a joke are intolerable to be with, and probably must be very unhappy as well.
On the subject of laughs, if anyone hasn't read Sebastian's book, Jeeves and the Wedding Bells, I highly recommend it. It is one of the funniest books I've ever read. I have to ask you, Sebastian, also about James Bond, because you wrote, in 2008, you wrote Devil May Care, an incredibly fun, I just loved it, continuation novel, I think it was described as, with the full blessing of Ian Fleming's estate. And I think at the time I'm right in saying it became Penguin's fastest ever fiction hardback novel. I mean, it was great fun. What do you make of the Bond franchise now being taken on by Amazon?
I have no views at all, actually.
I don't believe it.
sorry to disappoint you. I have no idea who the new actor will be. And, you know, I'm not that interested, really. I mean, I wish they would do an adaptation of my Bond book. I think Sam Mendes was interested in doing it, but it never got going. But there it is. Devil May Care, that should be the new basis for the new Bond film. And I don't care how much they muck it up. You can have a female James Bond. You can have a 158-year-old James Bond.
Oh, you could have a female James Bond. You'd be happy with that.
I couldn't care less, as long as they pay me tons and tons of money to use my book as a basis for it. I couldn't care less.
Just finally, Sebastian, now that you have written a memoir of sorts, I know it's a collection of essays, but was it?
It is a memoir, Roya. You know, I've got over myself now.
Okay.
I've stopped.
Did you find it cathartic at all, or therapeutic at all, writing it? Did it unlock anything that you did that you sort of didn't know at the time?
I think only not while I was writing it, but in retrospect. Looking back at it, the publication of it, which I was rather anxious about because, as I say, I didn't want to come across as self-important, but I think it's been rather gratifying. The messages I've had, the emails, the letters have been so heartwarming from people of my generation and indeed from a younger generation. The response has been fantastic, so that's good. But I had a very interesting little email from a guy called John Mullen, who's a professor of English at University College London, said, oh, love the book. It's really you in all its quirkishness. And I wrote back saying, dear John, I never really thought of myself as quirky, but anyway, I shall wear that badge with pride now. Yes, I think I have seen a sort of aspect of myself which I hadn't been aware of before. I've always thought of myself as tremendously rational and balanced and even-handed and so on. But maybe I'm quirkier than I thought. But that's been fun to find that out. I mean, really good fun. It's been a very positive experience, the whole thing.
Good. And finally, is there a new Sebastian Figgs novel underway or book?
Yeah, I finished the final edits yesterday. It's coming out next September. We haven't settled on the title yet, but it's probably going to be called something like Out of Eden or Farewell to Eden.
It's
about longing and transcendence and belief and religion and the meaning of life. Just a few little tiny little themes I thought, you know, trying to play around with. It's set in post-war Britain in a girls' boarding school and then goes back to Palestine in the last days of the British Mandate in 1946-47. So, and it's about all that.
Well, that was the author, Sebastian Foulkes, whose new book, Fires Which Burn Brightly, A Life in Progress, is out now.
I'm intrigued by the notion of setting his latest novel in a girls' boarding school and whether or not there are many female protagonists. Because, I mean, it might be set in a female boarding school, but actually be about the men who are running it. So
Yes, that's a good one. That's a good one to look out
for. I want to know who his sources were for his information about girls' boarding schools.
Yes.
Wasn't me.
The whole thing has lots of questions all over it. Delightful interview. And if you came in halfway through that, if you want to hear that one again, our 3:30 interviews are always available on the Offer podcast with Jane and Fee, which at the moment is with Fee and Eve/Hannah. It'll make sense if you listen to it. This is Fee Glover and Roy Anika, though, on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
How to Win an Election Special on Times Radio.
Do you remember when everyone agreed with Nick?
I agree with Nick. I agree with Nick.
I'm Hugo Rifkind, and for a new special episode of How to Win an Election, we're joined by Nick Clegg to take us inside the 2010 election, a campaign which broke the mould of British politics.
Nick and I wanted to put aside party differences.
There's going to be a lot of change. This is what new politics looks like.
How to Win an Election, featuring Nick Clegg, this Thursday morning from 10 on Times Radio. Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Cancer Research UK is funding the breakthroughs that matter. Did you know that over the past 50 years, their work has helped double cancer survival in the UK? Cancer Research UK science expert Dr. Sam Godfrey talks about the breakthroughs that could change the lives of people affected by cancer.
One of the breakthroughs that I'm so excited about is that our scientists discovered that the human papillomavirus actually caused almost all cervical cancers and a number of other cancers too. This has meant we've been able to develop a vaccine, and that is now expected to prevent almost 90% of cervical cancers in the UK. With screening as well, we think we're going to get to a point where we can stop almost all cervical cancers, and we're going to see a future where cervical cancer is effectively eradicated. It's such an exciting thing, and it just scratches the surface of what really is the golden age of research.
Witness more incredible research breakthroughs in Cancer Detectives Finding the Cures, brought to you by Cancer Research UK. Stream now on Channel 4. Cancer Research UK is a registered UK charity.
This is Times Radio.
So, we've got quite a few thoughts about Sebastian Foulkes. Matty is not entirely convinced. Oh dear, Sebastian, beware of the old ways of critiquing the young. No patience for the mental health of the younger generation, yet lots of sympathy for your younger self at Cambridge. Despite your copious reading, maybe you have little empathy. This one, though, is completely different. It's from Hillary, who has been listening with delight to Sebastian Foulkes, reminiscing about his childhood. So familiar, I'm just 29 days older than him. Please repeat the title of the book that was described as so funny.
That is his brilliant book called Jeeves and the Wedding Bells. And it was a book he wrote some years ago with the full P.G. Woodhouse estate blessing. And it is an absolute... I laughed. I took it on holiday and I laughed out loud so much that everyone around the pool where I was staying just kept staring at me like a weirdo. It is one... You know, Jeeves and Worcester books I adore, and I loved this one so much. And he had just absolutely got Woodhouse down to a T, but with his own special Sebastian Foulkes sparkle on it.
So isn't that a rare talent to be able to take on that kind of patina? I always say that word wrong. Have I said it wrong there now already?
I think you said it perfectly.
Okay, thank goodness for that. Of somebody else's writing when it is so well known and so distinguished. And obviously to be able to do the same thing basically with Ian Fleming, that is quite a trick.
I do remember talking to him before he wrote both books when he told me he was doing them and thinking, wow, that is to get into the mantle of P.G. Woodhouse and Ian Fleming, that takes a lot of confidence. But I think, you know, he approached it sort of undaunted, and I think that's the only way you can do that with two huge names like that.
Yes, definitely. You can't go in bowed, can you? It just wouldn't work at all. That's it from Roya and me for today. Roya will be back with me next Monday and Tuesday. Tomorrow, our big guest, and the we in that is me and Rosie Wright, is going to be Spencer Matthews, who is embarking on another one of his extraordinary expeditions. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Up next, it's John Peanut with Drive. Have a lovely evening when you get to it.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Roy. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. Serious failings by MI5 have been found by the inquiry into a British agent who infiltrated the IRA and carried out murders and torture. And Australia's become the first country to introduce a minimum age for social media users, forcing platforms like Instagram, TikTok and YouTube to block accounts of under-16s. And the deal to release 100 billion euros of Russian frozen assets seems to be coming closer. Just as fears grow, Donald Trump may be losing interest in securing a peace deal for Ukraine. We'll look at the stakes of both of those situations and talk to colleagues at Westminster, Washington and Kyiv.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. There are calls for a mole inside the IRA to be publicly identified after a long-running inquiry found the agent, codenamed Steak Knife, was involved in horrific crimes. The report also criticises MI5 for major failings, including delays in handing over key intelligence. Freddy Scapatici, who has never been officially named, was linked to 14 murders and 15 abductions as he worked in a ruthless IRA unit known as the Nutting Squad. The Times' chief reporter, Sean O'Neill, explains more about the man.
Freddy Scapatici was the most prolific agent British intelligence had within the IRA during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. He produced more than 3,500 intelligence reports, and his handlers basically turned a blind eye to his involvement in serious terrorist activity, including the murder of other agents, because they were obsessed with protecting him, because they were in awe of him, because they owed what this report calls a perverse sense of loyalty to them.
President Trump has called European nations decaying and led by weak people who are failing to control immigration or end the Ukraine war. He also launched a fresh attack on Sadiq Khan, branding him a disgusting mayor who he claimed had been elected because so many people have come in. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister has told the Cabinet the stakes remain high, but the UK is continuing to work with all of its partners to secure peace in Ukraine. Elsewhere, Donald Trump is allowing AI chipmaker NVIDIA to sell some of its microchips to China after a previous block. The company is the world's most valuable at £3.4 trillion. It's agreed to pay the US administration 25% of all Chinese sales, leading to the president's easing of the regulations. A former children's commissioner for England will lead the grooming gangs inquiry. Baroness Anne Longfield says her review will not shy away from difficult or uncomfortable truths. Her appointment is likely to be welcomed by many families, but some had wanted the inquiry to be led by a judge. Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood made reference to the Casey report in the Commons, saying it's not just the crimes that are shameful.
There was also an abject failure by the state in its many forms to fulfil its most basic duty, protecting the young and vulnerable. Worse still, some in positions of power turned a blind eye to the horror, even covered it up. Despite a shameful lack of national data, Baroness Casey was clear that in some local areas where data was available, and I quote, disproportionate numbers of men from Asian ethnic backgrounds were amongst the suspects.
Fraudsters taking advantage of COVID-19 support schemes cost the taxpayer nearly £11 billion. The COVID Counter-Fraud Commissioner, Tom Hayhoe, has told Parliament that programmes, including furlough wage subsidies and the Eat Out to Help Out scheme, were a golden opportunity to fraudsters. James Hurley is the Assistant Business Editor at The Times.
Looking at between sort of 5 and 10% error and fraud rates on some of these programmes, which is absolutely huge. If I take the Bounce Back scheme as an example, all you had to do to get a bounce back loan was essentially fill a form out. That's it. There were no checks. So, I mean, you know, it's once you realise that, it's pretty obvious that this thing is going to be targeted by fraudsters. And indeed, that's what happened.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, one in four teenagers between 13 and 17, according to a startling report, have turned to an AI chatbot for mental health support in the past year. Can that really be true? I mean, however you define mental health support, if it simply means troubled young people needing someone to talk to privately and turning to their smartphone, it's more than sad, isn't it? It's worrying, don't you think? Think of teenagers under real mental strain and needing expert personal help, relying on a computer program that's built to sound like a friend, tell them what they want to hear, and then go on to encourage them to come back again and again for more. There have been allegations, lawsuits from parents who blame chatbots for leading their children to suicide. Allegations strongly denied, of course, by tech companies. And fear of ours and our children's reliance on pocket tech has reached a pitch. Australia, of course, is about to ban under-16s from social media, or try to do that. Now, on today's show, we're going to be looking at our teenagers turning to chatbots for help and personal contact. Could it be a comfort in some cases? And if it is a worry, then what exactly is the problem? So, what are you thinking? Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times or a tweet to @TimesRadio. And a little bit later on the programme, Ukraine could be days away from receiving around 100 billion euros from the EU and the UK to stay in the war with Russia and keep the country going. Well, how would it be spent? It's badly needed, and maybe more so after President Trump's latest attack on European leaders as weak heads of decaying countries, which may just add to fears of Donald Trump walking away from the search for peace in Ukraine. We're going to be talking about that too. Firstly, a survey of 11,000 teenagers aged between 13 and 17 suggests a quarter of these young people in England and Wales are turning to AI for mental health support. That's 40% among teens exposed to youth violence. Many claim chatbots feel more private, less judgmental, and are quicker to respond than the overwhelmed NHS services. Experts warn that AI isn't built for therapeutic care, and it risks harmful guidance without proper regulation. So let's first of all check in on some of the background to this with Rosie Weatherly, who's from the mental health charity Mind. Rosie, welcome to the programme.
Hi, thanks, John. Nice to be here.
It's good to have you here. So teenagers using, and in many cases relying on, chatbots for mental and emotional support. Rosie, what is the evidence that that is happening?
Well, the study that's kind of triggered this conversation is of 11,000 children aged between 13 and 16 in England and Wales. And the study found that, as you said, half of teenagers have used some form of online mental health support in the last year, and 25% having specifically used AI chatbots. And that research was carried out by the Youth Endowment Fund. And they found that young people affected by serious violence were even more likely to seek help online.
Well, that's a pretty worrying metric on its own. I mean, what is the evidence that we have on the way these chatbots are being used by these young people?
I mean, I'm not a tech expert, and we're still learning about AI ourselves, and there's lots to be discovered. We are quite concerned about the potential risks of using AI for mental health support. And this isn't just for young people. This is not just our teenagers. This is all of us. But we are particularly concerned about groups that might be more vulnerable, including young people, people with existing mental health problems, for example. So using AI, it's not, as a therapist, in inverted commas, is not something that Mind would recommend, because this current safeguards don't seem to be fit for purpose. We're hearing anecdotal evidence and reports of people becoming a little bit dependent on AI, and we're hearing more and more cases of people becoming actually quite unwell following extensive AI use. That being said, we understand completely why someone would turn to AI for mental health support. And so we're not condemning or judging anyone that does so. Because